Welcome to Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Tristan Hallman. My co-hosts this week are Jen Emily. Hey, Jen.
Hello.
And Naomi Martin.
Hey, Tristan.
Today's guest will be Denise Paquette-Boots. Our Sarah Mervosh, who isn't in the studio today, sat down with her for an interview earlier this week. We'll play that for you. Editorial writer Mike Hashimoto will also talk about Thomas Johnson on his latest Hashing It Out segment, and so will we. But first, we'll also start with some old news. This week, our colleague Julie Fancher wrote about the efforts to find a person or persons who killed Melissa LeSueur near Segoville High School in 2007. It was a bit of an execution-style slaying. Julie joins us now in the studio to talk about that story. Julie, could you tell us a little bit about what stood out to you about this case?
Well, this case isn't very old when you think of cold cases. I mean, some go back 20, 30 years. This one's only about 8 years old. But there are a lot of suspects, but no evidence, no physical evidence, no DNA. But police seem to think they know who was involved or maybe who had been involved, but they just can't prove it. So I think that really stuck out to me that, you know, you have some people that you think may have been involved, but you just can't prove it. So I kind of wanted to look more into that.
So you and Tasha Shaparis have been writing about cold cases in Dallas, a cold case series that we've had in the newspaper. Could you tell a little bit about what kinds of cold cases are out there and why, you know, this one in particular was so sort of jarring to you?
Well, there are a lot of cold cases out there. About 50% of homicides every year go unsolved. So when you think about all the ones that happen in Dallas County, about half of those go unsolved. So there's a lot to kind of go through. This one kind of stuck out to me. As part of our series, we work with five detectives who, on their spare time, investigate cold cases. And this was a case of one of the detectives. It was his original case. He was there when it happened. And he has not been able to close it since then. So he keeps it on his desk. And when we met him, he just kind of mentioned, you know, one I have that just bothers me, I want it to be closed, is this one. And it had been featured on A&E's The First 48, where they go out and kind of document the first 2 days of a homicide. And so I got to talking to him, and I mean, it was one of those cases where he just is frustrated. He was, you know, there may have been drugs involved, and or there were drugs involved in her life. And so he was saying, you know, with these types of drug cases, people usually talk, but with this one, just everyone was quiet, and that's so unusual.
Speaking of drug cases, this one, could you tell us a little bit about this case and, you know, the victim and why she was killed?
Oh, sure. So the victim in this case is Melissa LeSueur. She was 35 years old when she was killed. Basically, what happened was on June 10th, 2007, she went out to a field behind Segoville High School to pick wildflowers and rocks with a friend of hers. And while they were out there, the friend said that she wanted to go get bug repellent, so she left. And when she came back, she told police that Melissa and her car were gone. They said they searched, couldn't find her, so they filed a missing persons report. The next day, police came out and began searching, and several hours later, a police helicopter spotted her body not far from where she had last been seen, in the flowers. And so they weren't really sure how she had died at first, but when they kind of looked further, they saw that she had been shot once in the head and once in the chest. So an execution-style killing. Nothing really had been taken except for her car, but, I mean, her cell phone was still there, her camera, her, you know, everything else that she had. Drugs were still there. So, you know, police kind of started looking. The first thing what they wanted to find was, where'd her car go? They found it a few days after her murder, but the person who had been driving the car crashed it and fled before cops could get there. So about a month would go by before they found this man, James Malloy, who is a homeless drug addict. But he didn't match initial witness descriptions. Was that, you know, there was a jogger who was nearby who said that she saw a white man coming from the field shortly after hearing gunshots, and James Malloy is a black man. So he didn't match what a witness had said. So kind of during their investigation, police kind of zeroed in on people that had been involved with Melissa. She had become addicted to crystal meth, so a lot of her friends were all of her friends really were in the drug world. So they kind of tried to talk to her former roommate. and two people that she may have been involved with, a father and son. And when they brought the father in for questioning, he was very out of it during the questioning. He said that his son had killed him, had killed her, but said first she had been stabbed and then she had been hit by a baseball bat, which were both incorrect. So it kind of discredited him as a witness. The son completely denied any involvement, but her friend, her former roommate, also denied involvement, but he had also recently been charged with slashing her tires like the week before she was killed. So there were
a very tangled web there.
Yes, a lot of people involved, a lot of players, but no physical evidence, and they just didn't have any reason to hold anybody. So they kind of let everyone go, and the case just has kind of gone from there.
With so many cold cases out there, how much hope do these five detectives have that they'll solve these cases? Not any particular case, but just making progress, especially since it's in their spare time, which I would imagine really isn't much time.
Right. Well, these detectives that solve these cases are the Special Investigations Unit detectives. So on top of police shootings, you know, assaults on officers, they're taking on these cold cases. So it really is not a lot of time to investigate these. I mean, what they have said is, you know, all of these cases, they don't just put them up on a shelf and forget about them. They remember them. But with the ones without physical evidence, I think it's just very, you know, the older they get, witnesses die, witnesses move, suspects die. It just, there's a lot of factors that can make it more difficult to solve these cases. So they, you know, a lot of the ones that they work are cases where families have reached out to them, typically on birthdays or anniversaries of deaths, and just said, hey, do you mind checking this out and seeing if there's anything in there you can go off of? Typically, I mean, another case that I've looked at is one where no one had looked at it for 20 years. And when they went, because someone called and asked, they found DNA evidence that had never been tested. So that kind of gives detectives more hope. But, I mean, with so many cold cases and so little detectives and so little time, it's just a lot for five people to do. But I think, you know, they want people to know they're not just forgetting about them. They're trying.
Well, Julie, thank you for coming in today and talking about your story. You can read more about Julie's story at dallasnews.com. We hope to have a special episode devoted entirely to the cold case series coming up within the next couple months. So look for that. We'll listen for that then. But thank you for coming in, and thanks for sharing that story.
Thanks, guys.
Earlier this week and over the weekend, we heard a little bit more about the Texas A&M receiver, the former Texas A&M receiver, Thomas Johnson, and the runner who he allegedly killed, David Stevens, over on White Rock Creek Trail. Naomi, could you tell us a little bit about, we'll start with the victim, David Stevens. You sat down with his wife earlier this week.
Yeah, and she was extremely traumatized. I've interviewed so many victims and their families, but this one definitely was, I think, one of the rawest. You know, it might just have been because it was a week later, but she really had trouble talking. And so I wanted to play a clip of her talking so you all could hear what she sounded like. But I just want to warn you that, you know, she had written down some of her thoughts in front of her. And so while we were talking, she would kind of, you know, start to talk. And she said that she hadn't been sleeping a lot. And so she didn't feel like she was thinking clearly. So she would keep like referring to her notes so that she would make sure not to say anything that she felt she shouldn't say.
Not that I want it scripted, but I don't want to say anything. I don't want to say anything emotional. I'll just say that Dave was the love of my life, and I'm lost without him.
That was obviously, you know, it ended up being emotional for her. What was she like when she was speaking the rest of the time?
She was extremely. It was so sad because you could just tell that she was so in love with Dave, her husband. They'd been married for 25 years, and she and Dave's parents also were there. We sat down at GE's office in Plano, where Dave had worked as an engineer, and you know, they were smiling when they talked about how great of a person he was and how he was just so kind and giving and thoughtful and, you know, wanted to be a better husband, a better son for them. And, you know, he would refuse to go through a door without holding it for her. And she would sometimes try to go through without and hold it for him, and he wouldn't let her. And just cute little things like that that made her smile. But then, you know, when she would inevitably return to what brought us to the interview, she would get very, you know, start crying. And it was definitely tough. And, you know, she talked a lot about his love for running, which, you know, went into why he was out there that day. And he was a marathoner. He had run 11 marathons. He always wanted to do a better time. And even though he was 53, he got 157th place in the Dallas Marathon last year, which is, you know, out of, you know, more than 600 finishers. So he beat a lot of people younger than him. And he was really proud of that. That was hanging in his office. So, yeah, it was a very emotional interview. And I just felt so bad, you know, for the family there.
It was actually something of a dual tragedy. You know, it's obviously different for someone who's lost a loved one. But Avi Selk and I reported a story over the weekend, or over last week, that ran over the weekend about the man who was accused of killing Dave Stevens, Thomas Johnson, who showed a lot of promise as a football player, both at Dallas Skyline High School and at Texas A&M. He looked like he was destined for the NFL. His parents, or his father and people around him, say that he was actually schizophrenic, that it started to manifest itself at A&M, and that he, before this, had never raised a finger, you know, to ever hurt someone. So they were just befuddled by this, and they feel like they've all failed him. He's in jail now. He had a lot of people in his life, wealthy, you know, wealthier benefactors, who came to his aid in high school back when he was not showing any signs of any sort of mental illness, when he was just, you know, the good kid. He never got into any trouble. It was definitely jarring to talk to them as well, and they're trying to cope with the description of this person who, it just sounds like a monster, and the person that they knew.
Did it seem like anyone knew what happened in the last few years? Because it seems like they all knew he had these mental issues, but it seemed to have gotten worse, much worse, recently, right?
Yes. By the time he got to A&M, it seemed like he became a different person, that he was starting to talk to himself a little bit, that he was claiming he had heard voices in his head, that he started talking religious speak, that he believed in Ted the teddy bear, from the movie Ted, that he believed he was real. He definitely had these issues, but they never saw it manifest itself in any sort of violent way. So they would see him act bizarrely, and that he would walk away from the house. He walked 20-something miles between Arlington or Hearst and Dallas to his mother's place, that they didn't know how he got around. He'd disappear if they ever challenged him on anything. That was his way of coping with confrontation, was walking away. So this was just shocking to them, that he would confront a complete stranger, and he allegedly, you know, killed him. And he, police say that he admitted to it.
Mm-hmm. So had there been any discussion of trying to get him help? I mean, obviously, if someone is violent and in, because of a mental illness, that changes things. But if they're just disappearing and doing odd things, like only talking to people who have biblical names, I mean, that is concerning, but it obviously doesn't reach the level of, I think he's going to hurt himself or hurt someone else.
The father said that he didn't really understand schizophrenia, that he didn't really understand the mental illness. And, you know, there was, he the son was kind of in and out of his life. He said that they tried to get him help, that Thomas didn't want help, that he would bristle at the suggestion of help, that they didn't really know what help they needed to seek. And they never saw it as that as urgent as it obviously became, but that they really didn't understand the mental illness in the first place.
This week, the state auditor completed its report of the Dallas County DA's office use of forfeiture funds. And forfeiture funds are money that is taken from people who are suspected drug dealers. And so if they have money or cars or other things, they're sold. And it's split up among law enforcement agencies to use for law enforcement purposes. And it turns out that while former District Attorney Craig Watkins was in office, his office misused a lot of those funds, or they just didn't provide receipts or documentation to know if the expenditures were kosher or necessary. The auditor looked at about $1.2 million worth of spending and came up with a lot of questions about whether the funding was properly spent. There was money spent on beads at a Mardi Gras parade and excess spending for hotels providing compensation or reimbursement for a larger amount than was really allowed by the guidelines.
What is this money supposed to be for? Can you talk a little bit about, you know, it comes from criminals or criminal investigations? And
it comes from criminal investigations, and it's not necessarily people who've been convicted of crimes, but people who are suspected of crimes, and they seize the money, and that's divided up among law enforcement agencies. And so it's supposed to be spent for law enforcement purposes. And so while it is legitimate to, say, a prosecutor goes to a conference to learn more about how to better prosecute murder cases, you can spend that money for that purpose. But there's a per diem, how much per day you're allowed to reimburse. And you can't spend, you know, on the Mardi Gras beads because that's not really a law enforcement purpose. And you have to have a lot of documentation. You have to show why it was necessary. You can't just spend the money any way you want.
So Mardi Gras beads, police don't need those, you're saying?
No, and I know, you know, you have a New Orleans background, so you probably advocate for Mardi Gras beads on any occasion, but not from the DA's office.
But Jen, fun is in the name of forfeiture fund, so.
That is true. That is true, but it's not very fun at all.
We talked to Cindy Stormer on the show a few weeks back, and she was bringing up these same sort of issues that she perceived with Susan Hawk. Obviously, their office denies that they were being the funds are being used inappropriately. But how big of an issue is this forfeiture fund stuff becoming?
It really is a huge issue across the nation. There have been some new recent restrictions about how you can seize the money and how you can spend this money. There's state money and federal money, and you know it's not a slush fund, and you can't use it to help your reelection campaign. You can't buy things and then take them and use them in your home or whatever. It has to be for law enforcement purposes. And the thing is that they did this report and found all of this mismanagement, but really what can come of this? Fines, which can be paid for out of the forfeiture fund. So, and, you know, it is possible if someone was really stealing money to bring criminal charges, but you'd have to prove intent. And being sloppy, while not the greatest thing and not what you would want from a district attorney's office, it's you know, it's likely not criminal. And with Cindy Stormer's concerns about Susan Hawk, a lot of her concerns are about Susan Hawk repeatedly asking to spend money on things that Cindy Stormer had said, no, you know, that's really not a legitimate law enforcement purpose. So I don't know that really funds were misused in that case. It was just maybe a lack of understanding of how the funds are supposed to be used. And if you put a check in place to, like, what Cindy Stormer was doing and saying, no, you can't do that because it's not allowed, you know, that's what's supposed to happen. But obviously Cindy Stormer's been fired, so I don't know what's going on there now.
As I mentioned before, earlier this week, Sarah Mervosh sat down with Denise Paquette Boots. Denise is an associate professor of criminology at the University of Texas at Dallas. She's also something of an expert in the domestic violence field, and you'll hear more about that. For the last few months, she has been researching how the city of Dallas handles domestic violence. Mayor Mike Rawlings announced the findings at an event this week. Now here are Sarah and Denise.
Welcome, Denise.
Thank you so much.
So first, let's talk a little bit about how this all came to be in Dallas. Domestic violence became a really big deal here, and Mayor Rawlings became almost famous for standing up against it.
Right. So back on January 8th of 2013, Karen Cox Smith was brutally murdered in the parking garage at UT Southwestern.
I remember. I covered that case.
That was a big case, and it really became an impetus, I think, for Mayor Rawlings' campaign and his campaign to end abuse, and he's reached out to men across our community and looking to get people to step up to call people out, really, on their behavior if they see people who are abusing their intimate partners, asking them both on formal levels in the workplace and in our informal groups on the golf course and in our churches and in our neighborhoods to hold people accountable for their behaviors. And so that really led to him looking at the Dallas Domestic Violence Task Force, which has been around since 1987 and has been a very active group in the community. But Mayor Rawlings asked Councilmember Jennifer Gates to become chair of that committee and really charged her with collecting metrics and data.
Because I know Mayor Rawlings, he made sort of his note by holding a big rally with Cowboys players and just famous mm-hmm. men. And lots, it was like thousands of men who came and said, I'm not going to stand for domestic violence anymore. But he wanted some more specific things that he could see more tangible impact with.
Right, right. So part of his public awareness campaign has been that outreach in the community. And that's a welcome thing, anything that raises awareness and really challenges the myths surrounding domestic violence. But another key component when we look at things more objectively is to say, you know, what job are we doing in Dallas? How well are we serving victims? What are we doing in our court system with our judges, in the police department when we get a call about domestic violence? How are those cases handled? And really, what does that picture look like? And really, up to this time, although the Dallas Domestic Task Force has been very active, we've never really had a baseline to look at. So a couple years ago, Councilmember Gates appointed me to the task force and then asked me to come on to the executive committee, which are some key players across Dallas, both in the nonprofit sector, like our shelters, such as Genesis, The Family Place, Salvation Army, Mosaic Services, as well as Dallas Police Department, the mayor's office, and Councilmember Gates' activities with the task force, and the district attorney's office and the city municipal attorney's office.
And so this is probably the first of its kind, the report?
It is.
So what does it say? What are the major takeaways that we should know?
So, you know, we looked across a number of things. We actually conducted a general survey. So we looked at the organizational composition of the general task force. So the summer of 2015, myself and Dr. Timothy Bray, who's the director for IUPR, where I'm a senior research fellow, we reached out to 87 members of the task force and sent them a general survey looking to see what kind of services do they provide victims. And we collected all of that, as well as their organizational structure, how long they've been a member of the task force, how active they are, what activities they do. And then for the last almost 2 years now, I've been meeting with those specific members of the executive committee, and we've been gathering detailed monthly metrics that I've been collecting.
And this is basically how many people are in the shelters, what capacity is, how right. well are we serving them?
Correct, correct. So, for example, Dallas Police Department let us know that between June of 2014 and May of 2015, we had about 11,000 calls to Dallas Police Department just in the city of Dallas that were domestic violence-related calls upon arrival at the scene.
Wow.
Because we don't always know when you get a 911 call, it could be a noise disturbance. But that noise disturbance could actually be a domestic event that's going on that the police really don't know what that is until they arrive on scene and talk to the people involved. So things aren't always transparent with domestic violence because they're intimate partnerships. They happen behind closed doors. And so we started looking at numbers like that. And then looking at, for the number of cases, for example, that go into the district attorney's office, what percentage are filed at the felony level, for example.
So you have 11,000 cases that are happen in the city of Dallas in, mm-hmm. in a year, mm-hmm. and not all of those cases go to the DA's office,
no.
but a portion of them do, mm-hmm. and then a portion of those cases actually get indicted and could possibly go to trial or take a plea bargain or basically be resolved in the courts.
Sure. And so you have two types of cases that come through, misdemeanor and felony. We had about 2,900 misdemeanor cases that went from into the district attorney's office. And that's not just Dallas Police Department, but any police agency in the county that reports to the district attorney's office and refers cases. And of those, about 90% were filed at the misdemeanor level. And then we had another 2,500 roughly that went to grand jury, and about 1,900 of those actually were found to be moved forward. There was a true bill returned and they moved forward on prosecution. So the vast majority of cases coming in that are filed with the DA's office are moving forward on prosecution.
So that was a pretty positive finding, I'm sure, to see that
very
cases
so.
Were moving forward. But one thing that I noticed in the report that was pretty startling to me was that about 7,500 men, women, and children were turned away
right.
in that year because of a lack of shelter space. And that seemed like a pretty large number to me. So Well, I mean, what does that say about our situation?
So on an average day in Dallas County, and this is, keep in mind, to you, that metric that you're talking about is just four shelters. So that's the Mosaic, Genesis, Family Place, and Salvation Army numbers. We had about 152 victims every day that were in emergency shelter. So that's a lot of people. But what that other number was, and that was a question from the mayor's office, is are we able to service all our victims that are coming forward? And so we asked our shelters, if you reached capacity, how many people did you have to turn away? So there were about 7,500 in that year period. Now, what that doesn't mean is that they didn't get shelter anywhere. They might have gone to one shelter that was full, possibly sought shelter somewhere else, or even come back the next day and had a bed, because those shelters are always moving on an emergency basis. But what it does tell us is that we have a huge need and that we're far away from meeting all the needs of all of our victims. If they were to stand up at the same time today, would we be able to take care of every one of them? And that answer is no. We have more to do.
And now, Denise, you and I have talked many times over the past, you know, several years. I did a whole series on domestic violence homicides in North Texas last year. And one of the things you and I have talked about is the mental state of people who commit these crimes, and particularly people who commit domestic violence, intimate partner murders. And you've mentioned things, qualities like shame and narcissism being really, really
central.
Central. And so that was really interesting to me. Can you tell us more about why those qualities play such a big role?
Well, I wouldn't say that every domestic homicide is the same, right? There's different circumstances and factors that come into that. But certainly there is an element based on national research that's looked at lethality reviews of domestic homicides. And by the way, I should say Dallas is one of those cities doing these things. We have a lethality review committee that is phenomenal. They released a preliminary report this a few months ago. They gave us that.
And how many murders, domestic violence murders, were there in that year period you looked at?
In the year we looked at, we had 10 of the 16 family-related homicides were actually intimate partner homicides.
Okay.
And that number's down from where it was, you know, a few years ago when we were at some higher numbers. And so there's been a lot of efforts, like Dallas Police Department going in and doing lethality assessments, which are really important to identify high-risk situations, and then going back and making contacts with victims. And they did quite a bit of that over the last year. And so those are best practices. When we look at those type of offenders, we see some variables. But one thing that's been a commonality has been that many of those offenders are either shamed or they have completely lost control, and they tend to be very self-centered, very narcissistic. That's not to say that every offender that is like a family annihilator that kills their whole family is doing it because they're a narcissist. Some rationalize it that they're doing their family a favor, but there is certainly a subset of those offenders who are highly, highly motivated to take the ultimate form of control over their victims. They'll either kill the children, you know, in front of the woman, or they'll kill the woman in front of her children. In other words, if I can't have you, no one will.
And I do remember, I interviewed several of those offenders in prison. I do remember them talking about, well, I lost my kids, or I was victimized in some way. And so there was that, yes, that sense from them. And Denise, this has been really interesting and really helpful. Remember that October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. You can show your support by wearing purple, by painting one fingernail purple, or by giving your time or money to local domestic violence shelters.
Yes.
Thanks again, Denise.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's all for us today. We'll go to Mike Hashimoto for his Hashing It Out to bring us home in just a moment. First, thanks again to Denise Paquette-Boots. You can read more coverage of domestic violence issues and all the stories you heard here today at dallasnews.com. Don't forget that you can follow us on Twitter at Dallas or at Texas Crime Cast. We are on iTunes, so we hope you subscribe to our channel. Our sound engineer and producer today is Brian Elledge. For Julie Fancher, Sarah Mervosh, Naomi Martin, and Jen Emily, I'm Tristan Hallman. We hope you stay safe out there. Now we drop the mic.
An op-ed column in the newspaper told us that we all had a role in Thomas Johnson's descent into murderous insanity. Instinctively, I reject such thinking. I didn't know Thomas Johnson. I vaguely remember him as a football player at Texas A&M, but not much more. I recall him walking away from school just 10 games into his freshman season. It was as bizarre as it was unexplained. But I didn't know him, never talked to him. How in the world was this my fault? Well, it wasn't, not exactly. Yours either, assuming that you, like me, had never met him. Until he ambushed and hacked a man to death on a popular Dallas running trail, we hadn't given him much thought. People through his life tried to help him. And yes, some of that concern was because he was an exceptional athlete, a great football player. But no one, it seems, connected his failing mental state with a need for professional help. Would that have spared David Stevens' life? Who can say? We cannot blame only the people around Thomas Johnson. That would absolve him of the responsibility for killing a random stranger. I can't do that. Yet I also have to ask myself if I've met another Thomas Johnson, not a great athlete maybe, just someone who needs help. What have I done for that person? And that's the question I'm wrestling with today.